Bob Hale and Ron Sanders of Booz Allen joining me in studio to talk about research on the Senior Executive Service. And thank you both, gentlemen, for being here today. Bob, I want to start with you. Overall, a lot of people are right now focused on the health of the Senior Executive Service, the work that you all have done, a number of other organizations looking at it. What is it about the current state of the Senior Executive Service that you think is driving this conversation, and what observations do you take away from your time as comptroller at the Defense Department about the Senior Executive Service people that you dealt with and the work that they're doing for the agency?
Well, thank you, and thanks for the chance to be here. First, what I take away from it is that they are critical to the success of government. I remember in 2013 being almost daily with the Secretary of Defense as we worked through issues of sequestration and shutdown, and then quickly going back to my office to a cadre of senior executive members who were helping me figure out what we ought to do, and equally important, once he'd made decisions, implementing those decisions. So they are absolutely critical. I think that there are problems, and I think my colleague Ron Sanders can be more specific for you. I'll cite a general one, and that is, as is the case, I think, for all civil servants, I think morale is down. 3 out of 4 years of pay freezes, 2 furloughs in 2013 certainly didn't help. Canceling the 2013 presidential rank awards, all of that did not help. But there are some structural problems as well, and I'm sure we'll get into them associated with the civil service they lead. So there are some problems that need to be fixed, but I want to end where I started, which is they are very important to government.
I'm struck by the amount of them that stay through all of the issues that we talk about, and the issues that we'll discuss, Ron, in a moment are certainly very serious. But as we saw just again within the last week or so, the retirement numbers for November, nothing particularly striking about them right along the lines of what OPM expected. And so, Ron, your view of this is an issue you've cared about and paid attention to for a very long period of time. Are you detecting a difference in the kinds of responses and the perceptions and the opinions of the actual SESers themselves in the work that you're doing now compared to the work that you did maybe a year ago or 2 years ago or 5 years ago?
Francis, thank you for the opportunity to be here, too. And I'll just echo what my colleague Bob Hale has said. You know, the Senior Executive Service, for the most part, is invisible. It's an invisible institution, except for the occasional scandal. And you know, there have been several of late that have put it under stress and scrutiny. And while the retirement statistics aren't alarming, they're more or less what they have been. And the long-awaited retirement tsunami has never really happened. The waves are getting bigger, maybe, but it's still not been the tidal wave. I'll tell you what I worry about more, and that is when I talk to groups of high-potential GS-14s and 15s. They are not as passionate about becoming members of the SES as I was when I was at their stage in their careers. Mm-hmm. And look, whether it's a series of ripples or a wave, today's career executive, 64% are going to be eligible to retire next year. They're going to retire. Maybe not immediately when they become eligible, but they're going to retire. I worry about the next wave, the next generation. Government's gotten more complex, and they look at their poor beleaguered senior executive, and they don't see much in reward in the way of pay or prestige. And certainly all they have to do is pick up the newspaper and worry about the risk. And so the best and brightest may be looking at that and saying, maybe not for me. Mm-hmm. And when you start, when the best and brightest start saying that, and those SES vacancies come open, if we don't have people ready and willing to step up to the plate, the very best, then, as Bob suggested, they're critical to government success, mm-hmm. and we suboptimize.
Bob, you addressed the point that Ron just mentioned at the news conference when this work rolled out. Federal Times reports you said we ought to be losing sleep over the fact that many of our 14s and 15s are not that excited about it. Among the folks that you talked to and the folks you dealt with in the Pentagon, what were some of the factors there? What were some of the things that drove them to say, I'm happy where I am. I think I'll get to 15, maybe take it all the way out to step 10, and I'm good.
Well, as Ron suggested, I mean, it is a quantum jump in terms of responsibility. You're taking on a good deal more management responsibility. You give up some of the job protections that you have as a GS-15. And there's not much, sometimes almost no difference in pay. If you're a senior GS-15, there's really probably going to be very little of an increase in pay. So not a whole lot on the incentive side and some concerns. I don't want to overstate it. We still have people, at least in the organization I was in, who are quite willing to step up. They want the responsibility. They want the authority that comes with being an SES. But we want there to be a substantial pool from which to draw so we get the best, and I think that pool may be diminishing.
Do we have a sense of how much of this, Ron, may be because of the conversations that revolve around the fact that the SES has not turned out to be what it was envisioned when it was originally stood up, the idea that we would have the idea that we would have this cadre of, I can't think of a better word than like super employees, who would go from agency to agency, that would move around a lot more than the SES seems to move, and their specialty would be very high-end excellence at administering government rather than the mission of a particular agency. That's my sense of how the SES was originally intended when it came into being. That's different than, I think, the description that people would have of it today. Am I on target there?
You are. I think that's, frankly, that's part of the solution. Because you're right. The original vision was this mobile corps of leaders who would bring that career excellence not just to one agency or one function, but across government, sort of a whole of government cadre of excellence. And that's clearly not what it's turned out to be. I do think we're looking at a generation of leaders that is attracted to that kind of career mobility. They want variety. We know that. It's not just an urban legend. Millennials want that sort of the ability to move around a lot and experience a lot of things. And I can't think of a richer environment to do that than in the federal government. That was the original design. The design has never come to pass. And one of the things we talked about at this summit that that Brookings Executive Education and Booz Allen sponsored was, all right, if that's still a valid vision, and to a person, we all said, yes, that's still worthy of aspiring to. If it's still valid, then how do we enable it? And we came up with a number of suggestions, many of which, Francis, you and I have talked about before. You know, if you say we want executives to be mobile, and we have executives who want to be, if you essentially leave them to their own devices, that's going to be very hard. Just a quick anecdote. I was down at the Federal Executive Institute about 2 months ago speaking to one of their classes. These were 14s and 15s. And their views of the SES were quite depressing because very few of them really said, "I want, that's what I want." But they also said something telling to me. They said, when an SES vacancy is posted in another agency, we typically don't bother because we know that in most cases it's wired, it's pro forma. They've got the vacancy, they've got the person, but OPM rules say that you've got to announce it, so it's announced. And it's the odds are worse than playing the lottery. I don't know whether that's true, but in this case, perception may be reality.
Yeah.
So, for example, we talked about enabling mechanisms that would allow or enable a career executive or an aspirant to move from one agency to another. Tish Long, who was there from the intelligence community, she recently retired as director of National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, recounted how the intelligence community does it, where they literally get together at the deputy director level and move the chess pieces around between agencies. You could easily replicate that at the PMC, for example. But you need some mechanism, whether it's a headhunting operation at OPM, whether it's a super executive resources board at the President's Management Council. Even within departments, there's very little mobility between the bureaus, and even something, for example, at the Department of Defense level would help. DOD had something like that. It's largely atrophied. But, you know, I do think that's part of the solution. If you can say to a bright young GS 14 or 15, not only will you get more responsibility, but you'll be able to go to the next hotspot, wherever the wherever the executive branch needs your expertise.
Mm-hmm. Part of that, I wonder if is might be a situation too where you're trying to present this to the leadership and make them understand this is something that I really need and want, so I'm going to get behind it and push it, Bob. So it seems to me, I mean, let's go back to that vision of the SES that we originally had, where somebody doesn't think that it's wired and somebody understands I might be at Commerce today and I might have an opportunity to come next year or the year after and go work at the Defense Department for a couple of years. What's the value of somebody like that coming into your organization and into the comptroller's shop with a very, very high level of financial management expertise, not necessarily homegrown, but a fresh perspective and also a very high level of expertise?
So, Francis, I agree with Ron to a point on this one. So let me say that first, and then I'll try to answer your question.
Please.
I think there's definitely a place for that kind of mobility. And I also, as the comptroller, realized I badly need members of the SES who want to understand the arcane financial rules of the federal government and have both the authority and the skills to implement the decisions related to them. So I think there's some mix that's appropriate. I'm attracted to some proposals made, and I wasn't involved here, but in a study done by Booz Allen along with the Partnership for Public Service that envisioned a highly mobile corps that would be doing interagency efforts and perhaps one that was perhaps less mobile but more technically oriented that would suit some of the needs that I had as comptroller. Now, to answer your question, I think it would be particularly useful to have those kind of skills when you are talking about intergovernmental efforts, when you're trying to drive change where we need the knowledge of other departments or the Department of Defense does. I think in many cases what the comptroller community does is more technical. It's still very important, but there I think I would want a greater percentage who have those kind of skills. So, mm-hmm. Ron, you should feel free to disagree if you wish.
No, in fact, I don't disagree. We've talked a lot about a so-called dual track mm-hmm. that lets individuals who are technically expert continue to practice that profession without necessarily being required to take on huge managerial responsibilities. Now, I think what Bob's described is a hybrid, senior executives who may not be managing hundreds of people, but they're managing some, and they're also bringing with them substantial technical and organizational expertise. I think there's room for all of that in this federal government. I do think, though, that by design or default, I think more the latter, the senior executive corps has become more technically and functionally focused and less so on sort of whole of government and, leadership as a general profession.
And the competitive obstacle that presents, we talked about before we went on the air, which is private sector companies are doing this. And if somebody feels like they have to be pushed to a management level that they're not comfortable with or interested in order to develop their careers in government, there's a very good likelihood that they'll say, well, I can go over here and just be a technical expert at fill in the blank somewhere in the private sector.
Right. And I'll have to tell you, that's even more acute at the GS 14-15 level, mm-hmm. where, again, it is very, very difficult under the general schedule to say to that super expert, whether it's a tax accountant, and we had some at IRS, or whether it's a cybersecurity expert, it's very hard to say you can be a GS 14 or 15 and just do that, not have to worry about managing people and mm-hmm. doing appraisals and doing all those other things.
Yeah.
Whereas the private sector commonly has that dual track, and they'll say, look, if you don't want to do that, if you just want to be world's best cybersecurity expert, come on, we'll take you. One of the points that the summit made was that part of the solution here is general civil service reform, because frankly, many career executives and career executive aspirants look at all of the rules that make it so hard to lead and manage in the federal government, and that's part of the equation, part of the question, is it worth it?
Right.
And that dual track is just one example.
How much of this, I wonder, is not just, we've talked about 14s and 15s and SESers. How much of it's further down than that? How much of it is the cultivation, maybe even as far down as the 7, 9, 11 level, but definitely the 13s, the folks who are going to be 14s at some point in time or 15s, who then will step into that role? You and I have talked, another issue we've talked about, Ron, is that trough. that the intelligence community in particular has dealt with, and other agencies too. But I wonder if that's a factor here, and what that looks like, whether those folks are being fed and watered in the way that we'd like them to be to eventually become the 14s and 15s who enjoy their federal careers to the point where they want to become SESers when they're qualified.
Yet another point to worry about, not to plug another Booz Allen Partnership for Public Service study.
Oh, because you would never do that.
I would never do that. But we did one on attrition. And one of the things we found that was quite alarming was that attrition was between 25 and 35% at the second and third and fourth year of an individual's federal career. What that said was they come in idealistic, ready to go, in many cases with an intern program that gives them varied experiences and sends them to training. Then they graduate, and then they're put at the desk in the cube and said, all right, now you're going to work this very small, narrow niche of a program. And many of them become very, very frustrated. They're ready to, they're raring to go, and they're kind of put in their place. And as I said, the numbers were quite alarming. So we've got to make sure that this is an entire pipeline solution. It's getting the recruits in the door. We want the best and brightest. But once you get them in the door, you can't stop worrying about them because they'll vote with their feet.
Mm-hmm. Bob, we've talked about a lot of the issues that leaders are facing when it comes to the SES. Ultimately, the solution is a solution that will have to work for people like you and the and others in the job that you held at the Department of Defense. As a political appointee, you rely on very high-quality SES people underneath you. You were very clear about your sentiment regarding the folks that you work with at the Pentagon, so I don't mean to try to get in the middle of that. But what would you like to see different about the SES concept or core compared to how it exists now, in order for you to be that kind, and your successors and your peers, to be the kinds of leaders that you would like to be in those very high-profile, very high-level positions in agencies?
Well, I think we could do a couple things to make it better. One, frankly, is pay reform. We need to have a greater pay, or is what it will take, so that there is some financial incentive to take on these extra duties. I know how hard that is, but it is an important part of the solution. As Ron said, and I couldn't agree more, we can help the civil service a lot by reform, or the SES a lot by reforming the civil service as a whole. We need to be able to hire people a little more quickly. We're trying, and I think making some progress there, but it still isn't as quick as it should be. And for a small number of people, we need to be able to fire them more quickly. Both I and my SES have spent an inordinate amount of time on a small group of people who are underperformers, and it would help a lot if there was less of that problem and cause less stress, and I think make the civil service more attractive. But I got to say, I think they're doing a great job, and I don't think it was just my organization through some very difficult times. And I'll end with one more thing that is important to me. I don't think we do as good a job as we should as saying to both the SES and indeed to all the civil servants, they do a lot of things right. And part of my goal now that I'm out of government is to say that more often. So let me take this opportunity to say it. And I won't take the time to be more specific, but there are just a lot of things they're doing that are good things and very important to the effective running of the federal government.
I'll get you back sometime to talk about a lot of those good things that people are doing. I'm struck by the work that you've done this time around, Ron, and how you've talked to the Bob Hales of the world, the people who do it on a daily basis, rather than I love my academics and I love my people like you who have been in and who have done it in the past. But you really, this time around, when you talked about this particular issue of SES, I'm struck by the people and the number and the high level of people that you talk to who are practitioners today.
Right. And I think you've just heard from Bob, you know, his in his own voice, the reason we focused at that level. We really wanted to look at the senior executive service from the vantage of sub-cabinet officials who are at the boundary layer. They, you know, they're there to translate the goals and objectives of an administration into action, and that translation typically occurs through members of the career executive service. So we wanted people who had to, you know, literally be see both ends of it. The need to be responsive to an administration, the institutional role of the career SES. So undersecretaries, deputy secretaries, bureau chiefs, we had a couple of dozen of them. And there was surprising unanimity amongst them in terms of the vision and role of the SES and trying to recapture that vision, as you and I discussed a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that we tried to do in this summit, Francis, is in addition to saying, look, you got to reform the civil service, pay reform for executives would be great. I'm not very optimistic in that regard. But are there things that could be done administratively that would make the lot better, make the career executive corps better, and help morale? And we came up with a number of suggestions. Those we'll lay those out in the blueprint in the spring. But things like the ECQs, the executive corps qualifications, I mean, those haven't been revised in decades.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't tell me the world hasn't changed.
A little bit.
And that's the admissions test for the SES. So it's like, for SATs, saying we're going to use the SATs we used in 1979, that's worth relooking, and I think OPM is beginning to do that. Candidate development programs, the batting average for CDP graduates, and I make no comment on the quality of those graduates, but the statistics show that you'd be demoted to minor league baseball if that was your batting average.
Mm-hmm.
Those programs don't provide much return on investment, so we ought to take a real hard look at them. The qualifications review boards, everybody says paper exercise. When I was at OPM, I ran that process. I sat in on dozens, and we ran hundreds. And you can't tell much from a write-up. And frankly, many agencies outsource the write-up.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me how much good that does.
Yeah.
So if you really want to worry about the character of a new SESer, there are ways to do the due diligence before that person is admitted to the senior service that are far different and more effective than looking at a narrative. So there are things that could be done. OPM has started. They've got this new onboarding initiative that I think is a great step in the right direction. But there are other things that could be done, again, with the stroke of an administrative pen.
Mm-hmm.
that we'll lay out. And look, I have to say that Director Archuleta and Deputy Director Colbert from OMB were tremendously supportive. They were there. They had staff there the whole day. They took lots of notes. They are committed to this because I think we all realize, as Bob suggested earlier, the career executive service is critical to the success of government.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we don't get it right, we're in for trouble.
We have more details about the event linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth Ron and Bob. Final thought, Ron, what does it take? You kind of teed this up a little bit, but what does it take to move some of these things beyond recommendations and advice and consensus? Because it sounds like a lot of people agree on the very important things that need to happen. What does it take to move it to actual action so that 2 years from now we're not back here having the same conversation again?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm especially encouraged by the commitment and attention that Deputy Director Colbert is placing on this because as an OPM alum, I can say this. It's one thing to have the government's HR organization plugging some of these things. To me, it's far more powerful when senior line leaders, the President's Management Council, the deputy secretaries, the chief operating officers of the government say, these are reforms that we need because these are the leaders that are going to make our initiative successful. I think when their voices begin to be heard, we can get optimistic. And the fact that we heard many of those who were on the PMC, past tense,
mm-hmm.
saying these things, I think encourages me. And I think they encouraged Beth Colbert as well.
Gentlemen, I thank you very much for your input, and I appreciate you being here today. Congratulations on this work.
Thank you.
Thanks.